Welcome to the Sound Off by Safe and Sound Schools with me, your host, Michelle Gay, presented by Entrato School Messenger, the premier school safety communications provider in the U.S. and Canada. After losing my daughter in the Sandy Hook School tragedy, I made it my mission to help protect every school and every student every day. Each week, here on the Sound Off, we'll explore the biggest issues affecting school communities, from health, security, crisis prevention, and so much more. You'll hear from today's leading school safety experts to share their experiences, knowledge, and inspiration. Hello, everyone, and Happy New Year. We hope you had a safe and healthy start to the new year. On this episode of the Sound Off on School Safety, we're looking back on the incredible season two that we've had. We brought you the leading safety experts and thought leaders to discuss issues affecting our school communities right now. From the COVID-19 pandemic, mental health and wellness, physical security, and so much more. So we're recapping some of our favorite moments and the lessons that were taken into 2022. Listen on for our sound bites with each of this season's guests. First up, have you heard of the school safety bundle approach? Well, pediatrician and doctor of infection prevention and control at Cincinnati Children's Hospital, Dr. Joshua Schaffson, weighed in on how schools can include COVID safety in their bundles. It was really helpful at the time and seems even more timely than ever. Take a listen.
The evidence is pretty clear that masks should be part of that bundle. They don't have to be. And if we don't want them, something's going to have to replace them. And so we should just talk about what else we would do to help protect our kids. Because the bottom line is that the best thing for kids is in-person school. I mean, that is essential.
100%.
We have to do it. So, you know, really, to me, it's about figuring out how we keep them safe. If masking is part of that, which I think it has to be, then we figure out how people become more comfortable with wearing masks. Think about uniforms in schools. So schools have dress codes, and some are more enforced than others. And then some require you to wear one of two color shirts that you buy at their store, and you must. And what benefit does that provide at school in terms of safety, in terms of health? I don't know. There's certainly a purpose. So if your philosophy is we need to require and have uniformity, then a mask requirement probably makes most sense to you. If it's, here are the parameters of our dress code, just be respectful, wear what you want, et cetera, then maybe you don't have to require masks, but, you know, you allow freedom. No matter what, kids need to feel comfortable wearing what they're wearing and being able to wear a mask.
Next, how author and suicide prevention advocate Kendra Nicholson believes we need to change our approach to mental health issues. Take a listen.
We don't share their mental health issues. We don't share their emotional health issues. As soon as there's a medical problem, we're all in asking for prayers. We're all in saying, hey guys, keep us in mind. But we don't give the same significance to those mental health issues that we do to the physical health issues, when really there should not be a difference, because obviously, as we're seeing with the crisis that we're in with suicide, that it is just as debilitating as any physical illness could be.
And here, Mikey Latner, founder of Project Camp, shares how his organization partners with schools to create pop-up camps that help communities recover from wildfires and other crises.
We're talking about right now rebuilding roads and bridges and broadband, which is correct. We also need to be talking about utilizing community and our community mechanisms. And it's actually been why schools have been a key component of who we've been working with, because there's, you know, we need three things that are essential from community partners in order to get camp up and running. And that's finding a host site. It's access to qualified volunteers, childcare professionals, kids with babysitting camp experience, and then also that trusted voice with families. And schools really tick all of those boxes. It's a space that kids and parents know.
Next, Dr. Stephen Brock and Dr. Melissa Holland joined us to talk all about burnout. Listen to Dr. Brock highlight why self-care must be a priority for teachers.
I would suggest that it's an ethical responsibility. for the professional educator, taking care of yourself isn't just a good thing to do, it's ethical. In other words, burning yourself out and not being available to your students is unethical. And that's actually something we really impress with our graduate students, who I think all too often as they enter the field think, I've got to be there for my kids all the time. And so we kind of like want to reframe for them the idea that to take care of others, you need to first take care of yourself.
Here, Dr. Melissa Reeves explains why social-emotional learning, or SEL, is important now more than ever before.
Because people have had to shelter in place or quarantine or have had to do virtual instruction, our youth have not been able to naturally develop a lot of these skills that you learn by interacting with people, by being with larger groups of individuals, by having to learn how to collaborate and cooperate and how to do problem solving and conflict resolution. They've missed a lot of opportunities not only to learn, but also practice these skills. And so that's also why, you know, we have many schools today saying we need to do more direct instruction around this because it is the foundation for academic achievement and healthy relationships. And given the fact that that natural development has been pretty much impacted and interfered with for almost a year and a half now for many of our students, yeah, we need to put some special attention to this. And what we also see is that when we spend the time doing this, we see less behavioral challenges, not only in the classroom, but parents can see that at home.
And Frank DeAngelis, dear friend and retired principal of Columbine High School, shares how embracing counseling helped him to move forward as a leader after the tragedy.
And I got into counseling immediately. And I think what's so important, a lesson that I learned, is when people's lives are out of control, like what you experienced and your family experienced, what I experienced, your life's out of control. And what you want to do is try to get things back into control, and that's difficult at times. But one of the things that you have to do is you need to be able, in order to help others, you got to help yourself. And I think that was the most important thing for that road to recovery, is reaching out. And it's how you model, because when things are out of control, you don't want to be told what to do. And I could not walk into the auditorium and tell my staff or people, my kids, well, you're really messed up. You better talk to someone. Because they're going to say, no one's telling me how to feel. But if I reverse that, when I walked in and I said, I'm not sure how you're feeling, but I'm not sleeping at night. I'm having these reoccurring nightmares. I lost my appetite. All of a sudden, I see people nodding. It's so how you deliver that message. And I think that's the most important thing now is leaders, whether it be school people, whether it be parents, whether it be law enforcement officers, you have to lead by example because people are watching us.
DEI educator and advocate Daniel Oganami speaks about the difference between diversity and equity.
Diversity describes all of us because we are singular people. We are singular beings. There will never be another us. We operate as ourselves. We bring a certain combination of individual and group or social characteristics that nobody else can replicate. We are diverse. Every last one of us is diverse. Now, what starts to get tricky is when we start talking about equity and inclusion, because a lot of that, we have to deal with some of the historical implications of America, and those aren't comfortable conversations. We have to deal with the question of what's fair, what's not fair. Why do we talk about equity and not equality? Like, we have to start asking these questions where a lot of people would just say, well, we're all humans. There's only one race, the human race. And while that's true, and even, you know, I identify as Christian, a lot of my Christian brothers and sisters will definitely resonate with that. We don't necessarily do a good job of understanding the totality or of what that means as a culture. And so, yes, while we all bleed the same red, there are elements that were derived of our society from more of the outward characteristics or how we describe or how we ascribe to be ourselves.
And in 2016, Molly Hudgens talked a student with a loaded handgun out of committing a mass shooting at Sycamore Middle School. The school counselor, author, and Congressional Medal of Honor recipient describes how the simple act of listening can change a child's life.
I don't pretend to think I can solve the problem of every person that ever shares, you know, a challenge or an issue they're going through. But I think sometimes it's just knowing someone is listening. And even if I don't have advice to give, even if the only thing I can offer is, honey, this really hurts you, I can see that. The kids are like, somebody sees that I'm in pain. Somebody sees that I'm hurting. And I really believe that healing starts with recognizing that we are in some type of pain. And the next step is sharing that with someone. I don't know how effective it is for people to be going through a challenge and never talk with anyone about it. I don't know that that is has a very good success rate in terms of working as best practice. So I try to always think when kids come in and talk to me that I've got to figure out what their real underlying issue is.
Chief of U.S. Secret Service National Threat Assessment Center, Dr. Lena Alafari, breaks down what schools can learn about threat and behavior assessment from the Secret Service.
I want to look at the thinking and behavior of individuals who are engaging in behavior that should elicit concern. And when it comes to students, this behavior could include suicidality, inappropriate and obsessive interest in previous incidents of attacks, in attackers, behavior changes, conflicts with peers, and also in addition to the behavior, as I said, the circumstances. A lot of these kids that have gone on to conduct these attacks were dealing with either mental health symptoms, and in the age population of K through 12 schools, as you know, that most includes depressive symptoms and suicidal ideation. They were dealing with significant conflict. Some were the subject of bullying. We saw that 20 years ago, and we see it again in our research, that bullying still is a factor in driving someone to resort to violence as an option to deal with their circumstance. As I said, the negative home life factors, these adverse childhood experiences, including parental incarceration, drug use in the home, abuse, neglect, and so on. So when you have a multidisciplinary team, you can be looking at what are the behaviors that we should be aware of. And that's why training is so important. Unfortunately, we've seen incidents in which they did have a threat assessment, but that threat assessment was not done properly because that person had never received training on how to do a threat assessment. So just having a team in place in itself is not alone. You've got to be training on the behaviors. And really, if we are focusing on behaviors, then it's being done right.
And listen in as Dr. CJ Huff discusses how long-term recovery is often left out of the school safety conversation following a disaster or crisis.
Every disaster, I mean, they follow the same kind of pattern. And you're right. I mean, we spend as a country, you know, time and effort and money in that preparedness piece. Very little of the effort is really focused on the recovery. And I think there's a shift that we're starting to see with the federal government, FEMA, and other agencies that are really understanding more that this long-term recovery effort is really where we need to be spending some more of our time and preparing communities for that. Because that's where communities fall apart, is that recovery piece. We saw it, I think the first time we saw it was after Katrina.
An encounter with a student helped Dr. Beth Sanborn, a detective and school resource officer, understand the true role of SROs, connecting with students.
He was a high school student. We interacted regularly. And I was standing in one of our primary intersections in the high school where at class change, it's like a sporting event letting out. And there's 1,400 sweaty adolescent bodies all pushing past each other. And it's just a throng of kids. And I just hung out afterwards as the hallways were emptying, because there's always your meanderers. And he walked past me. He was like, "Hey, Officer Beth." And he said to me, I really like that you're here." "Thanks. I like being here, but I like seeing you too." And he's like, I don't really like cops, but I like you." And that was a big deal, because he's not the first kid who's ever said that to me. "I don't like cops, but I like you." And here's the thing, that he had reason not to like police officers, that in his short life, he had had some experiences which you can sympathize with, which would really give you lenses that you would understand why he would have such an adverse reaction to someone in uniform. But he liked me because he was able to talk to me and look me in the eyes, and we were able to interact, and he was treated with respect. And what happened was, at least part of the goal of this position is bridging that gap, so building those relationships.
Officer Jermaine Galloway, founder of Tall Cop Says Stop, and the Tall Cop himself, gives advice to parents and families who are concerned about drug and substance abuse.
It all just comes back to being active. Being active, paying attention, staying within your lane and doing what you can, and being okay asking for help when it's outside of your lane, right? You don't have to understand everything I do. I don't have to understand everything a counselor or psychiatrist does. I just need to know this is outside of my expertise, but this child needs help and I need to refer them or get someone else involved. And if you can do that, many of our kids will be healthier and you'll help them leaps and bounds. You really will. And even when we think they're not listening to us, they're listening to us. They're listening to us. And you'll catch that when they repeat something back you said and you didn't think they were listening. They're listening. They're paying attention. They're paying attention to your behaviors as an adult. So, you know, many parents drink alcohol. You can drink alcohol, but drink responsibly. Your kids are paying attention to you. So they're watching you. They notice, you know, they notice these things. So if you're there getting sloshed drunk every time the Sunday night football game is on, what do you think they're going to do? Because it's a learned behavior and they're learning from you. Most of our kids learn everything from inside the house.
And my Safe and Sound School's co-founder and fellow Sandy Hook mom, Alyssa Parker, opens up with me about her healing journey after losing her daughter, Emily, in the 2012 tragedy at Sandy Hook School.
I stopped feeling things. Like, I started to feel numb to the story, and that kind of scared me, right? And it's been an interesting year in the sense that fog is lifting for me. And I felt this wave of emotion just coming over me as we prepare for this. And I always thought that feeling kind of numb those other years, you know, and I do think this to some extent does happen where, you know, you just, your body just needs a break and you just have to not feel things for a little while. Mm-hmm. And I do think that some of that was in play, but I think that reconfirmed for me the importance that I needed to be able to bring back some of that emotion again. And it wasn't to feel overwhelmed or to feel sad, but just, I needed it to feel some element of raw. Like, I wanted to feel close to Emily again and to not have it be a story that I repeat and tell all the time. And so it's been interesting because it's been a couple of years since I've felt this kind of emotion. And I think that was in part because of that. That my body just compartmentalized to some extent to allow me to do what I was doing. And that was just my body's way of processing it, you know? So it is interesting because it's kind of something I haven't had to feel or see to this degree in a few years.
Vic Krishnan, General Manager of Entrato Digital Workflows, details how the company streamlines school communications to better prepare for crises.
We've definitely talked about the problem where information gets into wrong hands. It's also a problem where information is getting into no one's hands, right? So it is still very common. It's probably the most prevalent situation you'll find where an emergency plan is physically written in a binder and it's sitting somewhere collecting dust, or there's that, and then that sheet, as we all know, that's kind of pasted next to every door in the school. Information isn't getting into the right hand. So that does tie back into how an emergency is actually handled during an incident, right? Because we can make that easy through our tools, where our tools actually enable the plan to actually be acted out.
Truly.
Where, you know, we're not asking people during an emergency to read the plan on their phone during an incident because it's digital. But we're running the plan, right? I mean, our Entrato Safety Suite can actually run that plan during an incident, so nobody has to be reading a binder during an incident. That's never going to work.
And Nick Savarese, Executive Director of the Doug Flutie Jr. Foundation for Autism, highlights how schools can unintentionally leave students with special needs out of safety plans.
You know, I used to work in the schools teaching special ed, you know, around the turn of the century, I guess, like in the early 2000s.
I just remember,
even like fire drills, they would tip us off ahead of time. They would say, we're going to do a fire drill, so get your crew ready. And so we basically wouldn't participate in the fire drills because we'd like leave the school early. So it wasn't really a fire drill for our kids because, again, they had the sensory issues and it was essentially at the time, it was the right thing for them to do, tell us so that, but at the same time, are we preparing our kids for the fire that might happen, right? No.
Well, what a season it has been. If you want to catch up or go back to our show at any time, you can play all of our episodes right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you to our presenting sponsor, Entrato School Messenger, for supporting season 2 of the Sound Off on School Safety. And thank you for listening and supporting our mission. Until next time, stay safe. Stay safe and sound, everybody.